This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. It seems appropriate that we are now going to two speakers from the conference, Techno-Utopians and the Fate of the Earth. It was held in New York City on October 25th and 26th, 2014. This teach-in was presented by the International Forum on Globalization and the New York Open Center. It was recorded by Dale Lehman of WZRD Radio. Starting with Charlene Spretnak on The Resurgence of the Real.
And our final panelist today will be Charlene Spretnak. She is the co-founder of the U.S. Green Party and the author of Green Politics, The Resurgence of the Real, Relational Reality, and many eco-social essays. She was named by the British government as one of the 100 eco-heroes of all time. And her newest book, The Spiritual Dynamic in Modern Art, was just published this week. Charlene will be speaking today on the importance of understanding organic, dynamic interrelatedness in assessing technology. Welcome, Charlene.
I'm going to come at this subject from a somewhat different direction, building on these astute critiques my fellow panelists have given about essentially a lot of examples they stated from what is the mechanistic worldview. And that, of course, has shaped our systems of knowledge. It shaped the way we were all socialized and the way we relate to technology. So the mechanistic worldview holds that every person and every entity is essentially separate and discrete. And entities, whether they're people or marsupials or poplar trees, they can be in some kind of relationship or not. But that certainly doesn't affect their internal constitution and the way they function physically. So that's the mechanistic perspective. But there's also a relational perspective, which acknowledges that every entity exists in a field of dynamic interrelationships. And they definitely do affect how your internal organ systems work and how you function in the world. And the interrelationships are dynamic, meaning they're always in flux. They respond to minute changes. They're creative, unpredictable, and full of possibilities. Now, even in the 19th century, there were some people who saw there are some real problems with the assumptions and premises of the mechanistic worldview. And really, there's been this attempted correction of it going on, at least since 1905 with Einstein's two papers, which established a relational perspective on matter and energy. But it's turned out that the mechanistic worldview has been very difficult to dislodge. And you may remember that there were a number of best-selling books in the last quarter of the 20th century, and these were all about the implications of relational discoveries in quantum physics, and then chaos theory, and then complexity studies. And these books asserted that soon this relational thinking from these discoveries would ripple out and transform all our institutions. Right. We can look around and see that our institutions were not transformed. And I think that's probably because the nature of those discoveries was too abstract for most people to pay a lot of attention to. But the millennial turning came and went, and I was still waiting to see the big correction, the grand correction to the mechanistic worldview. And I have to admit, I really got to a point where I thought, I may not see this. It may not happen in my lifetime. The prevailing view of the human organism as essentially a biomachine, a very complicated biomachine. These discoveries were actually revealing, they were surprising because they were revealing the extent to which the human organism actually is structured by and functions through dynamic interrelationships. So I had bulging files of this eventually, and I drew them all together and presented them in this book, Relational Reality, a couple of years ago, So I'm going to give you just a few examples. One of them was they did a study a few years ago of 906 elderly adults, and they found that the ones that had few friendships or other social interactions had a rapid decline in motor function, standing, gripping, balancing. And then there was a study 2 years ago, 2012. This is about children, the development of children. And they found that children who between ages 5 and 10 experience violence, either physically being brought on them or even witnessing violence, those children then had an erosion in the telomeres, which is part of the DNA structures in their cells, a shortening of the telomeres, which is what happens in the aging process. And the study found that the more types of violence the child witnessed, the faster the telomeres eroded, shortening their lifespan. So direct and even observed violence affects the human body at the cellular level. And then also our body-mind is in dynamic relationship not only with other people but with the rest of the natural world. So one study a few years ago of people who live in the projects in Chicago in this one housing project, it found that the residents who were at the far end of the project next to trees and green open space, they not only had less anxiety and depression, but they had many fewer incidents of physical diseases like diabetes, asthma, intestinal problems, and back pains. So there are so many, actually, recent discoveries about the relationship between humans and nature that you may have noticed that hospitals have now redesigned their decor to have nature motifs, which costs a lot of money. So that's how established it is, only in the last 12 years with all this research. And if you've been in a hospital recently, you may have noticed the drapery often has a leaf motif. And in the patient's room, they've put a big photograph of a mountain scene. And in the corridors, they have these little water fountains, you know, with water running over stones. And sometimes in the MRI room, the last thing people see when they're being rolled in is the blue sky with white, fluffy clouds. So the reason they're doing that is because it's been very firmly established that connecting with nature, even through a photograph, helps our healing process. And I call this new field of knowledge that's emerging relational physiology. It's different, I feel, because these discoveries, unlike the earlier ones, are so concrete and so accessible, and it's moving very quickly into mainstream areas. But what I'd like to focus on in the time remaining is just one of our organs, the brain, because it's always been held in the mechanistic view of the human body-mind, of course, that we arrive in this world with a certain capacity of mental functioning. You might be born smart or born dumb or something in between, but it's understood that you arrive with a certain kind of brain, and that's it. Now, however, that assumption is being strongly challenged by several studies that found there are numerous relational factors from infancy on through childhood that affect the development of an adult's level of intelligence. So here are five examples of what I call the relational physiology of intelligence. The first one's breastfeeding. So researchers have realized for a long time that breastfeeding is good for the physical reason that there are neurosugars in the breast milk that helps brain development. But now studies have also determined that the hours of interaction between the mother and the baby are exchanging all kinds of information through touch and language and other body language that stimulates brain development. And one study said that it controlled for lots of socioeconomic factors, but it said a baby who is breastfed for 1 year without other food being added yet gets a 6-point bounce on an IQ test, even though we know there are problems with IQ tests, but a standardized intelligence test. 6 points is what they determined. Number two, certain brain disorders. There's the example of autism. This is a new study that was just published last month by the University of California at Davis. You cannot make a definite diagnosis of autism before age 2, but as young as 6 months, certain symptoms start to show up, like rapid eye movement or fixation, unusual fixation on an object, or abnormal repetitive movements and not wanting to make eye contact. So this study identified a number of infants who were symptomatic between ages 6 months and 1 year, and it divided them into four groups. One of the groups got this therapy called Early Start, and they trained the mothers, and sometimes both parents, how to do certain motions, certain sounds, often down on the carpet with the child, certain movements every day. And by the time these babies were 3 years old, the group that had had the early start intervention had no symptoms of autism, no language delays, and no other developmental delays. So this relational interaction had affected the brain and probably the synaptic pathways. And then number three, family dynamics. Well, about 25 years ago, it was noticed by some researchers that, again, drawing on the IQ test, the firstborn child, eldest child in a family, tends to generally, score 2 or 3 points higher on the IQ test than his or her siblings. So, of course, they figured there must be something going on with the brain of the firstborn. But in 2007, a study was done in Norway of 2,041 military records of 18 and 19-year-old boys who have to go into the service. And the researchers then, looking at these records, had not only the IQ score of the test the military had given, but it also had the family history of each boy. And what they found was, if the firstborn child had died early in childhood, or even if the first two children had died early and the third born had been raised as the eldest, that child then scored the extra 2 or 3 points on the IQ test at age 19 that's generally seen of the firstborns. So family dynamics were affecting the development expression of intelligence. And they didn't speculate why, but you know, parents tend to give the eldest child more responsibility, watch the kids, we're going out, and the eldest tends to identify more with the adult world and test-taking. It might have something to do with that, but they didn't say. And then, number four, violation and damage to the developmental process. It's been found in many studies, cross-culturally, that whipping, spanking, beating a child lowers IQ. And the more spanking, the more it lowers the IQ. And culturally, if it's accepted and expected that all children will be whipped or spanked, you can see culturally, collectively, the scores are suppressed, even factoring in for socioeconomic factors. So the violence is apparently an anti-relational trauma to the whole system. And then last, number five, language and the relational formation of our intelligence. A researcher named Betty Hart found in the mid-1990s that children who were exposed to a lot of language in conversation before age 3 did much better in reading and math and intelligence tests in school than children who had heard many fewer words during that period. So there's been a lot of studies recently working off of that and developing it. And one thing they found is that if the child was hearing a lot of words in conversation, not from the mother or primary caregiver, but rather from the television set, it not only didn't have the same effect, it had a detrimental effect on their intelligence abilities later. Before I go on, let me just say the baby Einstein device, do you remember that? Why that went by the by? When those children got to first and second grade, they had lower ability than the ones. So what I started to say before I thought of that, you cannot substitute the organic with the technological and expect that it's not going to be damaging. And that fact is apparently very widely recognized among high-tech parents in Silicon Valley. You may have seen some of these articles in the paper where they go to these big names and say, wow, your house must be like an electronic cottage, the journalist will say. And the guy says, oh, no, we don't let our kids go on that. And they said, really, you don't? No, they, you know, either have no televisions and computers in the house or screen time, or at a certain age they'll let them have 1 or 2 hours a week. Or they send them even to Waldorf schools, no TV in the house. So one of the journalists asked these high-tech couples why they keep their children away from screen time, and they replied, quote, because we've seen what it does to people who were raised that way, unquote. Meanwhile, of course, their own company's marketing departments are just going full bore to convince parents all across the country that it'll benefit their child hugely to have them glued to a screen from infancy on, when, in fact, this electronic immersion is tremendously damaging to their development. So, in summary, we are just now beginning to grasp in mainstream venues that we human organisms are far, far more dynamically interrelated than modern thinking ever assumed. And of course, this deeply relational nature of reality was and is self-evident to indigenous cultures, but we hypermodern folks are pretty much at a kindergarten level of figuring out our own physical nature and how we work. It's not the way we were schooled. So one way for us to assess the effects of technology in our lives is to pay attention to whether time spent on an electronic device is significantly reducing the time and availability we need for organic relationships. But we face two difficulties in making assessments like that. First, because modern people are socialized in the mechanistic worldview, every new device seems really swell, and we're slow to see the detrimental effects. And second, because we do not yet recognize all that needs to be protected in this life, it's hard for us to make those assessments. But just keep in mind that we exist in, each of us, every moment, we're embedded in these gazillions of organic dynamic relationships. It's exhilarating. Thank you.
You just heard Charlene Spretnak, a founder of the U.S. Green Party, author and ecofeminist.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.